Come one, come all, and welcome back to Ladies with Gumption. We recap DC TV in a flash. As you may well know, after 37 episodes, 38 episodes, I am your introductress, May, and I'm here with...
Katya.
And Jessica.
Once again, you can contact us on Twitter at DCTVGumption, on Tumblr, ladieswgumption.tumblr.com, or you can contact us individually on Tumblr. Tatiana is Valerie M. Perez. Jessica is Falling in Love in a Flash, and I am her own hero writer. You can listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, or email us your lovely thoughts, suggestions, feedback at ladieswgumption@gmail.com. And as a friendly reminder, June is for Candace, has started today, so please send all your lovely affirmations to Candace and fill her tag with positivity. And before we introduce the format this week, we will discuss news about Swamp Thing, which Jess will talk about because I did not read it this week.
It's James Wan, so that's exciting. But yes. You have the breakdowns.
Yeah, he's the James Wan is the, also the director for Aquaman, which is coming out later this year. But he is the creator of Swamp Thing, which is going to be on the DC Universe. The hashtag show got the breakdowns of the two leads. And so the first is the female lead of the series. She's going to be Abby Arcane. If you want like a comic reference, she was in the DC Comics Swamp Thing number 3 back in March 1973. Live action is a 30-year-old something intelligent woman who is a bit of a lone wolf. She works for the Center for Disease Control and ends up assigning her to investigate the Homa flu, which happens to be in her hometown. Tragic past consists of her losing her mother when she was only 8. And she ended up moving between multiple foster families. She performs well with her job. She has a bit of a power struggle with her employer. And there's a tragic reason why she left Homa to begin with. So I guess Homa is her hometown. That's where the flu originated. Which is why she goes to the Center for Disease Control. She keeps a secret that has caused her to develop a pill addiction. So it could be kind of dark on this show for her, at least. So, and then we have the
And then he will introduce her to love of homeopathic medicines. She can commune with nature instead.
And this, and the he you're talking about is Alex Holland.
Yes.
Who is going to be the Swamp Thing. He's the lead of the show. He is also a 30-something-year-old wise man. So this is going to be the Dirty 30s. The show's in the Dirty 30s, y'all. He has a big passion for his work as a researcher in the Sunderland Corporation. And the company is building a hospital in Abby's hometown in Homa. So when she returns to town to investigate the Homa flu, Alec forms an instant bond with her, and he discovers that they are very similar people. Wow. They're both
riveting stuff.
So, they're both incredibly invested in science and not caring too much about having a love life. Little do they know. Alec discovers there's a connection between the Homa flu and the swamp, which is making people in the town hostile with him as well. And despite the bad attitude he gets from citizens, he's determined to get to the bottom of the flu. However, things go haywire when Alec is put into an odd transformation in the form of a swamp-like creature with extraordinary abilities. So basically, this is how the basis for the show, how these two people meet in her hometown, investigating a flu that is probably more than just a flu. And that combined with the swamp atmosphere is what the chemical X that turns Alec into the Swamp Thing. So it sounds kind of interesting, more interesting than I thought it would be when I heard the title Swamp Thing coming to the DC Universe. But what do you guys think?
I mean, it sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it definitely sounds more interesting than I would have thought. Like, the only thing I know about Swamp Thing is when he appears in, like, Poison Ivy stuff. And he's like, the green! And she's like, the green! And every once in a while, he talks about Abby and is sad. So that's all I know. And I'm like, who's Abby? I don't know. But now I know that's who Abby is.
Yeah, I was going to say, too, I don't know that much about it. But the premise sounds fascinating. I think that they can... I'm not sure how popular it is. So maybe because it's not as big as some other stuff, they can play around with things to make it, you know, people won't bitch, people won't bitch as much.
It sounds kind of Walking Dead-ish, and like the whole Center for Disease Control and something is in the water in Homa and turning people, or at least Alec, into a swamp creature. So I think there's a lot that can go with it. And they're both in their 30s, so this is going to be like geared towards a more mature theme and audience, so I think it could be interesting to see what they do with it and what he does as a Swamp Thing. Like, you're a Swamp Thing, so now what are you going to do?
What are you going to do next? Life plans.
Go to Disney World!
All right, and that is your only news for this week because it is dry as fuck. Moving on to our show, we are going to talk Supergirl, which is still on the air until June 18. We're going to talk about our likes and dislikes as usual, season predictions, then crown one lady with gumption of the week, who is obviously going to be from Supergirl. and then we will move into our special for Flash and Arrow, where we break down the Tornado Twins and Emiko Queen, and also talk a bit about Batwoman. Moving into Supergirl, What Would Sam Do? Our host for this episode, Jessica, will take it away with her recap.
So, Kara and Lanel are on their romantic getaway to collect a space rock to defeat a Kryptonian Satan. Kara shares with her totally platonic ex-boyfriend that she loves not having to pretend to be someone she's not out here with him in deep space. They're surprised to find the space rock they need is on an alien civilization, and after dodging the military and donning disguises, they finally make it to the house where the rock is stored, only for a shocked Kara to realize it's a Kryptonian memorial and that they are on Argo, the lost city of Krypton. Sounds like the perfect timing for a mother-daughter reunion. Allura shows up right in time to save Kara and Mon-El from the robot police. Kara explains that Earth is in trouble because followers of Unical sent world killers after her, and she needs the rock of Utica to stop them. Allura explains that the rock Huron-El is not hers to give because it's the only life source keeping Argo's atmosphere inhabitable after the fallout caused by the destruction of Krypton. But she agrees to convene the High Council. While they wait for the High Council, Allura and Kara catch up on old times, with Kara gushing over her adopted family and Allura apologizing for her past mistakes. Meanwhile, in town, Mon-El plays White Jesus for her mom and her kid who's suffering from Valenite lung cancer. Kara pleads her case to the High Council, and dun-dun-dun, the world killer mom is there, Serena. Jula accuses Kara of becoming too human, and apparently her speech of legacy of sin outweighs the need for survival, and accompanying montage of Alex and Lena being badass is not enough to convince half the council to give her the rock. The other half vote with Allura to help, and Serena breaks the tie, pretending like helping is what she wants to. Meanwhile, back on Earth, someone's trying to kill Alex. Their first attempt to take her out while she's auditioning to be Ruby's new mother. Whether they decide to do this now, all the seasons and episodes, we don't know, but they are. Alex thinks the culprit might be the newly released from jail Rick Collins, the sheriff from the Midville episode that killed Kara's friend Kenny, and she killed Kenny and wound up being Alex's first arrest, but he's white and male, so he gets a redemption arc and not a revenge plot. Alex switches gears and sets up a honeypot, which John impersonates her and pretends to be vulnerable to lure culprit out. While Alex and John play cops and assassins, Gwen babysits Ruby. He's sleep deprived and search for Kara and annoyed and takes out on Ruby. He later apologizes, telling her that he literally knows how she feels because he too had an evil parent that tried to kill him, but both agree that they aren't like their parents. Alex spots her attacker and pursues without waiting for backup or regard for her own safety, and winds up apprehending the brother of a season one villain that I neither care nor know anything about, and afterwards confesses to John that as much as she loves the idea of being a mom, she also loves her job and she's afraid of having both. John tells her he knows that she'll know what to decide when the time is right. Over in Argo, Kara says goodbye to her mom, and Mon-El scores brownie points by telling Allura how much he and the world love her daughter. Finally, Rain is growing immune to kryptonite, and Lena is worried that she may have to flip the kill switch to flood Rain's kryptonite, killing both her and Sam if Supergirl doesn't get back soon. She asks James for advice, to which he responds, WWSD, what would Sam do? And Lena responds that Sam would want her to protect Ruby, even if it meant killing her. Rain grows strong enough to break free of her jail cell just in time to welcome Kara back home. A fight breaks out, and that's what she missed on Supergirl. What did we like about this homecoming episode for Kara?
I already know what
I like that Jessica. I like that Jessica manages to make caramel sound romantic. So there's that. I thought that there was a lot more that I liked the first time that I watched it, but then when I rewatched it to remember what to write down here, I was like, it's kind of like meh. It was kind of a boring episode to me, but that doesn't mean there wasn't things to like, because I really did like Alex and Ruby's dynamic and how they're already like in a position to rib each other over things like Alex's crazy driving apparently and how dorky Ruby looks in hats. So I thought that they were really, really fun to watch together. And I liked how calmly Alex got Ruby out of the way before she started dealing with the, like, grenade threat at hand, right? and that she does with it very creatively. So I love Alex. Super proud of her. She's the best. And I thought that Alex's realization at the end when she was talking to Jean was very poignant. I liked that conversation that they had. It felt realistic. It's something that a lot of women go through. I also agree with May's point that she will say in the future, which was that I liked seeing Kara talk about Earth's heroes while the screen shows us Alex and Lena, because yes, they are in fact Earth's heroes, just like Supergirl is, but in a different way. I also thought that Wynn's inability to babysit was hilarious, and I was feeling bad for him while I was watching at the start of the episode. I was like, God, this guy has no life. Like, he just stands in front of the computer all day long in the DEO waiting for Kara to come back. And then he actually ended up basically saying that to Ruby, which I'm glad that he realizes as well that he doesn't have a life and that it's very upsetting to him. So I also thought it was fun to see Ruby sort of check him with her own feelings of upset, because the way that he was talking to her in this episode is very reminiscent of how Ruby was talking to Alex in the previous episode. So even grown men can be babies when they are sad. So yes, I liked it. And yes, I thought him asking Ruby for help at the end was a nice touch, like, because, you know, sometimes you just want to feel useful, right? Even though, like, a lot of the times you just want to lie around and do nothing. But when you're feeling, you know, when you're feeling the way that Ruby is right now, you want a distraction. And so Wynn helps himself and helps her by asking her to assist. Erica Durance is a national treasure for Canada because she's Canadian. But, you know, you go Canada. I love her. And I'm so glad that they are finally utilizing her as Laura. I think that she and Melissa bring out the best in each other acting-wise. And Melissa did some of her best work in this episode talking with, just like catching up with her mom, you know, and also sort of like making her case for Earth. I also thought it was like a nice moment when Allura was accepting of Mon-El, right? Without thinking, like, she sort of like alludes to their previous divisions, but then she's like, you're welcome here. Cause there's no Krypton, there's no Dexum. So we'll just be friends. It was nice. I also thought that, like I said, the scene with Kara talking to Allura about Earth and about her family there was really powerful, and it adds to the weight of the choice she's going to have to make in the near future about whether to stay on Earth or to go live on Argo. Because as much as, obviously, she's felt without her home planet and without her mother, she's felt that loss for 15 years, she also has built her own family and her own life on Earth, which she is very proud of. Finally, not really finally, pretend I didn't say finally, Mon-El's scene with the baby Val, with the little kid, was really cute. I feel like his little cure, like Brainy's cure, worked way too fast, because he was like, wear it for a week and you'll be good, and then like 2 seconds later he was like,
like, you know, he pulls it out and it's like, I can breathe instantly. It's it's not realistic, that gift.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's like, because he literally just said wear it for a week, and then suddenly he was like, right, I'm good now. It's like, oh, okay.
That's why I call him White Jesus, because it was, like, immediate.
Yes, but despite that logical fallacy, I thought it was very cute. It's nice to have those little moments where we see that Mon-El really is a good guy now. Even if, as I've previously said, I still don't buy, I don't want him with Kara, you know, or even around. But I do acknowledge and accept that they have done a good job rehabbing him. So, yes. Now, the finally, for real, Lena confiding in James was one of the better scenes of the episode. And I like that he continues to act as her voice of reason and her, not just her moral compass. He really kind of is the show's moral compass. Specifically for Lena, I really like how they balance each other. And I'm glad that they're getting breathing room as a couple.
Not surprisingly, I agree with a lot of what you said. And speaking of Lena, I love that she admitted that she didn't know what to do and that she sought James out for reassurance. I think the show has been doing so well with this relationship in the back half of the season, and I like that James didn't answer immediately, but the answer he came back with was instead to ask her, what would Sam want you to do? And I think framing it that way really helped Lena focus on the Sam aspect rather than what she herself was going through and what she was going to do. Also glad there was no Lena and Kara interactions, because we needed a break from their tension. And I also like that even though Kara was off on her own mission, Alex was getting her own major subplot, and that it was a story where she ended up expressing herself regarding who she was, what she wanted in the future, and how to marry the two sides without losing that part of her. And I love that Jean was there for her and that his speech let her know she'd be great at both being a mom and being an agent. Because like Tati said, women struggle with this all the time. The message of not letting go of one dream just because you also want a new one is a nice message. And I loved how protective Alex is of Ruby. And I love their relationship. It's so sweet. And I can definitely see her becoming like, you know, a surrogate mom some point down the line, maybe. And I've always loved Erica Durance, and I was so happy to finally see her on the show in scenes that weren't memories or dreams. And she was finally real and concrete, and I think her reunion with Kara felt natural. And a scene where they're catching each other up on their lives was simultaneously heartbreaking and very realistic. And I also like that they brought back the idea of Kara still trying to figure herself out with regards to who she really is. Like when she says that being in Argo City means she no longer has to pretend and that she can just be herself. It's just a reminder that Kara still hasn't really found a balance. So I feel like they're coming back to that. And Rain taunting Lena made for some good drama. But I hope this isn't part of driving Lena over the edge. Specifically, like saying you're darker than you realize from Rain means nothing and shouldn't be a weight Lena has to carry to get to the dark journey the show is clearly setting her up for. Finally, I really thought that Kara's speech to convince the council to let her take the Heronel was a strong one, and the way it was edited to show Alex running after the alien and Lena trying to figure out Rain's situation was excellent and really drove home the everyday heroism aspect of the show with the non-powered characters.
Yeah, I thought like Kara's speech was very like powerful and emotional with the montage. It was like a really good girl power kind of moment. For me, I liked Wen and Ruby. And I liked that Wen was like the worst babysitter. And that, you know, not everyone has to like kids or feel naturally inclined to them. So I was a little glad at least somebody found Ruby annoying. And I feel like it's more realistic. You know, of course, I also like that when he realized he was being a little bit standoffish and kind of an ass with her, that he went to apologize, and the fact that he drew on the parallel of his own evil parent, it felt like it was a really natural progression for their dynamic, and, you know, kind of a, instead of them just being buddy-buddy immediately, there's like a nice little short little period of growth there, and, well, a period of growth in a short time, so that was kind of cool. What else did I like? I enjoyed all the moments between Kara and Laura. I felt that it was really emotionally heavy and sweet, and I was happy for Kara to have her mom back. And I agree with Tati that like it was some of Melissa's best work, especially like when she was like shocked and saw Laura for the first time and how she was kind of like stunned. I thought that was really a great scene. I did not like the Alex B plot, which I'll get into later, but I did like the conversation with John that came out of it about motherhood versus the dangerous career that she has now, and how when the time comes, she's not knowing whether she'll have it or both. And I thought John gave her some really good advice. I don't think she needed to be killed or have an assassin after her to figure that out, but I'll get into that later. The James and Lena scene was really nice. I like how they're gelling as a couple now. And I like that James is kind of like the only person that Lena seems able to be vulnerable with now. Like all of her walls are down around him and she leans on him for advice. And he gives good advice. So he didn't like preach like Kara would have recently. You know, if Lena had come to Kara or Supergirl with it, she might have gotten a speech. But with James, it was wasn't about right or wrong, but really what would Sam do? Which is the best way to kind of answer that question. I mean, like, if you think about it in terms of a real-world situation, Sam is on life support, basically, with more or less Lena having to make the decision whether to hold off on the chance that she gets better or to let her go. And it's, like, a difficult decision that, you know, a lot of people have to deal with just with loved ones. And so the way that James, it was framed in James's advice, wasn't, like, preaching that this is the right way to do it or this is the wrong way to do it, but it's what would, you know, Sam want you to do. So I thought that was really, really good scene. And then my Carmel report for this episode, while it definitely wasn't as many scenes or as like romancy angst between them as I was expecting with them going off on a mission alone together, I think there were at least more moments between the two than maybe you ladies thought. I guess I like that he gave Kara and Allura space to reconnect. Like, he just made himself conspicuously absent during that time. And that he spoke very highly of Kara to her mom. And I like that he didn't unload his feelings because guess what? It's not about him. So I like that he didn't use that opportunity to kind of unload on her in the midst of her emotional vulnerability with her mom. So that was great. But what did we not like about this episode?
I was going to say that First, before I acknowledge my dislikes, I will say that in rewatching, I did notice a couple more, like, deep sighs from Mon-El, the sighs of longing, so they are still putting that in there, but it is very much just like Mon-El on his own little island of feeling, and Kara just doing herself, so, you know, just doing her, so that's fine. Anyway, things I did not like. Well, I was not a fan of Kara and Mon-El finding Argo so easily and getting into their disguises, and just everything was just like, oh, okay, well, here we are. Like, it happened within, like, a minute of the episode starting. And it seemed kind of strange to me, considering that the mother and daughter have not been able to connect for 15 years, right? So I really have to believe that they gave some random explanation for why they weren't possible, like, it wasn't possible to connect to Earth from there. But then I was like, how come they can't tell life on this planet, but they could immediately find the signature of Black Kryptonite or whatever? So, like, what is the thing that they have that only stops people and not other things? I don't know. I thought it was strange. And it also seemed, like, super convenient. Like, I was like, oh, of course they need this Kryptonite, which, of course, is only found on this rock. And, of course, it can't be taken because it's what's keeping them alive, etc. So I was like, all right, this string of fate is a little bit much. I also thought I didn't like Kara and Allura against the council, like, oh, finally we found people of color to be in our episodes, but it's like this whole council of people that don't want to give a little bit of their life rock to Earth. And then they have to be taught empathy, basically, by the white people. And I was like, this is uncomfortable, especially because there were people on that council that agreed with Allura and Kara, like, the whole time, but they didn't speak until they were told to raise their hands. So I was like, why couldn't one of them have given, like, the good side, you know? Like,
and you know what else? All the people of color, I guess the remaining people of color of Krypton were in the High Council because there's none of them in the city.
Yes! But they only had a certain number. They wanted it to look good. They're like, all right, high-ranking POC, yes. So, yeah, I would have much preferred a debate between, I don't remember these people's names, but, like, so that dude that said no, and then the lady that at the end said yes, she could have been the one that was like, oh, I see Kara's side. Let me talk about this. And then the dude could be like, oh, that makes sense, lady. And then they agree. But instead, she was like, I take this dude's side. And at the end, she was like, oh, you've convinced me. I was like, okay, whatever.
And that's Serena. That's World Killer Mom.
Oh, that's her name, Serena?
Yeah. Oh, okay. And Jewel S is the other guy.
What's his name?
Jewel S.
Jewel S.
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah. So it's like, I wish that the people had gone to speak instead of just raising their hands at the end. But yes. So Julius. Okay. Well, that's good. I'm glad you remember names. I'm very bad with names. This scene also, when Kara is asking Argo for help with World Killers, reminds me that she hasn't asked Clark that I know of for help. And that Clark is just somewhere on Earth not helping with World Killers that are going to kill the world. So I don't understand. And then that takes me back to when Brainy's like, oh, without a Legion member, that's only 51% odds. And with a Legion member, it's like 80% odds. It's like, what if we also had Superman? Would that increase the odds? Has anyone thought about asking Superman? No? No? Bueller? So, then I just couldn't concentrate on the rest of the episode because I'm just like, So, anyway, I don't like that.
It is. They introduced Superman. So now that they have, it's stupid that they don't even mention that, oh, well, you know, Clark is off-world doing some mission elsewhere, you know? At least that would have been an excuse, but...
Yeah, Clark must be in space for 6 months.
She brought up Clark when she was talking to her mom, because she said that Clark made it to Earth, but they don't talk.
We don't talk anymore.
Kara doesn't
lost his phone number. It's stupid. All right. So yeah, and I know that's not really the fault of this episode, but I felt like for whatever reason this episode really drove this point home for me, and I was like, how? Also, as like Jessica said, I liked the realization that Alex came to. I liked the conversation he had at the end, but the wild goose chase part of the episode was not very exciting, and I think that Supergirl has this problem often. Like, I like the emotional core of the Win and his mother plotline, but the whole like, who is doing the toy man things? Oh, it's really the prison guard lady. And so now it's like, oh, it's really the brother of the dude from Fort Roz. And I was like, who is this? The Midvale storyline with the sheriff from Midvale was much more interesting. Not that I would have wanted him, you know, to be a killer again, right? I didn't need it to be him, but it would have been more interesting if they had done, if they're gonna do like who was trying to hurt Alex, maybe he could have helped her or whatever, had some more of a storyline between them and like what happened and like resolving what he did in that other episode, because we actually saw that and presumably still care about that, than for this twin brother guy to be like, remember from season one and I hate you now.
Yeah, and it's kind of like stupid. That is with the Justice League or whatever, when Lex takes over the Flash's body and then he like unmasks, like, I don't know who this is. That's how I felt when he like, yes. When she, like, Alex finally like saw the guy, like, I don't know who you are.
Yeah. Right. And so like I got that her point was like, oh, I could be in danger at any moment, but it was really deflated to me. Especially yeah. Because she was supposed to then realize that she needs to balance being a mother with being an agent. But from the beginning of the episode, all she talked about was how this is going to affect Ruby. So she didn't need to make this realization. She already knew this. So it kind of brought down the poignancy of that final scene, because it was telegraphing the whole episode. Like, this is what the theme is, you know? Mm-hmm. It would have been, in my opinion, more interesting or more meaningful if she hadn't been thinking about Ruby throughout the episode until something happens and then she realizes that she could have been hurt and then what would happen to Ruby. Because then you're like, oh, I have to wake up and realize this, and not like, I knew this and then I still made this jump. And then after I made that jump, I was like, you know what? I shouldn't have made that jump. Like, okay. It's like when you're like, I'm going on a diet, eat like an entire pint of ice cream. I shouldn't have done that. Wow. Yes. Correct. You should not. But anyway. Speaking of unnecessary repetition and telegraphing things, I thought the Lena and Sam scenes kind of dragged. this whole like, oh, you can't kill me even though that you have to kill me, and also like, oh, I'm getting so close to breaking this glass. I was like, okay, I get it, thank you. The final scene was really cool, and I should have put that in my likes. I thought the final scene was like, that was a great cliffhanger moment. Like, oh, she broke the glass just as Supergirl comes in. Oh, what's going to happen next? But, like, that would have been just as cool if we hadn't had, like, 40 moments beforehand of Sam / Rain being like, oh, I'm coming. So, yeah, I didn't need it. I just needed, like, the Lena and James scene and then the final scene. That's all.
What's interesting is, like, I wonder why they, I mean, if Rain is obviously affected. She wants to kill Ruby, and then she's like, no, I have my own moral, weird, twisted moral code. But then they could also try to use Ruby to draw out Sam. I don't know. They could potentially have made that interesting.
We haven't gotten to that part of the plot yet.
Right, I'm getting ahead. But
obviously coming.
Well, I was excited about the fact that the person who wanted Alex dead was the same officer from the flashback episode in the first half of the season, continuity, and then it became about some rando alien guy from Fort Roz or whatever, who I don't remember, and after the letdown of it not being the cop, the whole plot lost a lot of its depth and intrigue for me. And it added some more in the end, but the impact of the actual death threats got a little lost. And so, like, I agree with Tati that Alex could have had that epiphany later on. I also did think for sure that Mon-El was going to take the chance and finally tell Kara how he feels, since they were off alone on the trip together, but it never happened. And to me, I only watched it once. I did not see any longing looks. Maybe I missed the sighs. I don't know.
You don't have your love radar on.
Apparently definitely not. It's salted caramel for me. And I just feel like it was weird that there was no comment whatsoever. And it feels like a missed opportunity only because I think that they are still trying to build it up, but nothing's really happening. So I'm not sure where they're going, since the primary reason Mon-El was sticking around anyway was for Kara. And even on his trip to Argo, he wasn't very much involved with anything that was happening, which is fine because, yes, Kara was doing her own thing and it was her mom and all of this was involving her. And he did have that like nice scene with the kid, but Jess in the future is right in that the trip wasn't about Mon-El, but I also feel like it's the writers stalling. And we've talked about this before a little bit, but the fact that this show really can't cast a woman of color in any positive role and not as a villain will forever be annoying. And if you notice, like in a lot of Hollywood movies and TV shows, there's always the person of color who's like the cop or the judge or a lawyer or somebody in a high position, but they never have bigger roles that are more important. They're just like, look, we're inclusive because these people have authority, but they're not really doing much, you know? And finally, this is a nitpick, but after years of not seeing her mom, Kara's not gonna hug her goodbye. Like, she just nods and leaves. I thought that was weird.
It's only one hug per episode, May. She had her hug in the beginning. That's it. That's all you get. That's how the Kryptonians do it. I thought it was, like, I agree with you, Tati. I thought it was, like, ridiculously easy how Kara and Mon-El infiltrated Argo, stole disguises, and then walked around the city in plain sight. Like, that just didn't make a lot of sense to me. So I also had, like, a kind of a random question. Like, how did Allura know who Mon-El was, but not that her daughter was alive? And I guess, I mean, I don't know. I guess it depends how long Krypton, I guess it's 15 years. If it's the same time that, you know, Kara went to Earth, but then like Mon-El's just a child then, so she couldn't possibly know Mon-El what all the shit that he's done, but somehow she knew about him but didn't know that Kara was alive. It's just a little weird to me. The whole Alex plot was also weird to me. Like, I get what it was supposed to represent, and it made her line from last week, like she said something like, I'll protect you for the rest of my life. I'm like, wow, foreshadowing. So that made sense this episode. Because I thought it was odd that she said it at that moment, the previous episode. But I thought that the death plot was super random. Like, they could have done this whole motherhood versus job moral dilemma in a way that illustrates what Alex is going through now and not dredge up, like, forgettable season one grudges that have no connection or relevant to the current plot. That guy, like, we don't know who he is. I don't really know or care, I guess, because it's Fort Ross, and Allura was talking about Fort Ross. They thought it would be connecting somehow, and it just was not. It fell flat. And he wasn't even a memorable villain. So, yeah, that was just a no for me. The Midville cop was a nice tie-in, though. But I kind of agree with May that if it wasn't going to actually be him, why bother with this stupid plot at all? I feel like they just wanted scenes of Alex jumping rooftops, which was also dumb, by the way, for, like, action scenes. Which, in that case, why not just make Kyler Supergirl? Because that's all that she's been doing recently. Like, they're doing all, like, these action kind of scenes, and she's kind of, like, the de facto... They've given her everything but superpowers, pretty much. And Alex didn't really need to babysit Ruby to recognize that maybe she should value her life more than she does with her job. And she didn't even almost die. And I would think that her almost missing the jump and maybe, like, John catching the bad guy and pulling her up in time would be enough for her to, like, reconsider how she approaches her job and the potential of that, you know, being a mother down the line if this is the way that she wants to go. I thought that would have been, like, at least that would have been better. And I was, like, on Twitter, and I guess Supergirl Radio was, like, how did she even make that jump? Because that her jump from the rooftop onto the bad guy was also kind of unrealistic, and someone said maybe it was like because her gloves are like magnetic, so maybe she attracted to the gun and that helped her get up. But they didn't, and that makes the most sense. And that's how I'm going to think that that's the way that it happened. Because otherwise, again, they're just making Alex superhuman without the superpowers. Like superpowered without the powers, or you know what I mean. But it wasn't shot like that. So the director didn't give the sense that that's how she was making that jump from almost falling off the rooftop to falling on top of that guy. And so it's either like a directing thing or it's a script thing that it wasn't written in the script for the director to shoot it that way. So just kind of like an odd kind of scene. And it makes it look like Alex is indestructible when the whole point of her plot was that she is destructible. And, you know, that kind of thing. So I thought that was, you know, I didn't like it. I think it's ironic that Supergirl was able to find an actual Indian woman for the show, but only when they needed a villain. And I feel like we've talked about this before, I think, in here, and then Tati and I wrote with an accent article with Ivy about seven things taking the super out of Supergirl, about how Supergirl can often be super white, and how off-putting it is that the only time that they really get women of color representation on the show is when it's either the character is a woman of color, but she's played by a white woman, or the woman of color is playing a villain. So it's kind of like we can only write about women of color stories if the woman of color is actually a white woman, which is not the best. Because otherwise, you have Magan, who is another hero, but she doesn't get any screen time. Like, she's played by an actual woman of color, so I guess her story doesn't matter because she wasn't in half the season that she was originally casted for. Season two, you had Roulette, played by Daichin. I can't remember her last name. It starts with an L. But she is a villain.
Lockman.
Woman of color. Daichin Lockman. Yeah. And she is a woman of color, but also a villain. All three world killers are women of color, with only the white passing one getting any kind of depth and development, and then a shout-out redemption because the others were dead. And now we have, like, the mother of the world killers is played by an Indian woman, Anjali Jay, and this is Serena. And in the comics, it was Kara's father that played the integral part in creating the world killers. And since the show prides itself on, like, girl power, it would have made sense that here they would change it to Allura for the show. And I remember in the beginning, we were talking about the world killers and what that could mean. We were, like, predicting the season. I said that, you know, it makes sense that Allura would be the Zor-El in the storyline. And even in the beginning of the season, Sam was also having dreams about Allura in the field, I feel like. So thus all the foreshadowing was there for Allura to be a part of it. Now all of a sudden Allura seems to be like the innocent one, and it's all Serena on her own evil world or whatever. Yeah, so it's just kind of sad that the only two like women of color with the most characterization are like Maggie and arguably Imra, because I think that she's been sort of coded to be a woman of color, and of course she's played by a white woman who routinely plays a brown woman. So it's just kind of like not a great look, and I'm not sure what Supergirl writers are doing to, or the show really is doing to like counteract that's the way that they think, especially like, you know, again, with the High Council, all the high, like Allura was the only white woman on that High Council. But so that's like, you know, look, diversity. But if you go out into the city, it's white people everywhere. So it's, yeah. They have a lot of work to do still, I think, on that side. Anywho, getting into predictions, what do we think is looking forward to the rest of the season?
I mean, so all these years, Argo has been around, and I feel like no one bothered to check on the supers. So I'm not buying that. And something is definitely up with Allura, and she could very well be siding with evil, with Serena. I called her Evil World Killer Lady because I had forgotten her name also, but Serena. And so I think there's something up with that because it's what, episode 19, 20? And they could be setting it up for later this season or next season, I'm not sure, but I think it would be a missed opportunity if they didn't use the whole dream stuff in the beginning to follow through on that, you know? And I also think that Mon-El will potentially move to Argo instead of going back to the 30th century because he feels like he could really help the people there like he did with that little boy and be around people who are closest to him culture-wise. And I feel like Kara's realization about being herself will resonate with him, and that's when he'll decide he feels like himself in Argo, and that's where he would want to stay after maybe Kara rejects him. I don't know.
I do agree with there have to be a connection between Allura and the World Killers just because of the dreams. But and also Serena, because why would she agree? I don't know, like her agreeing to give the rock, right? Mm-hmm. Must have some other, there has to be some kind of backup plan, I assume. So I don't know, I guess we'll see what comes of that. That's my prediction, is nothing, that there's a backup plan. but yes, I do think that Allura is shady and that will be a reason that Kara cannot stay with her, even if she's not like evil. Like I doubt they'll make her mom like outright evil, but like maybe there was some shady beginning there that connected them, and that maybe Allura didn't know what became of it.
I feel like with Serena giving the rock, it was just like a false positive. So maybe there's something extra to this rock of Utical or the Haranel that Kara's team still doesn't know. Like maybe it accidentally makes Rain stronger instead of weaker or something like that, which is why she's pretending to play along. You know, of course, there's like a lot of foreshadowing with Kara in this episode. Like I don't have to pretend, I can just be me, and her saying that she doesn't need a disguise. Or wishing she didn't need a disguise like Kara Danvers while she was on Earth. So, and now her mom and her people are alive, so why wouldn't she have thoughts of like going home? I'm less optimistic about Allura not being squeaky clean than you guys, just because, like I said, like, you know, white people tend to get off easier here. Like even the sheriff that killed a kid killed, and Kenny was Asian, so he killed a man of color, and he got like a redemption arc in one scene. So,
It'll probably be like she didn't know, you know, like
she didn't know.
Or it was like Allura of the past, and not her new version of her or whatever.
Right. I think that if she is, like, I agree that if she is dirty, then that would probably be the only thing keeping Kara from wanting to move to Argo when it's all said and done. So maybe it will be a villain twist reveal. I feel like they have to bring those dreams back in some kind of way. Otherwise, it just looks like they forgot their own plot. So that's that. Do we have Lady with Gumption noms for this episode?
I guess it's between Alex and Kara. But I feel like I want
to
give it...
I feel like they made it super easy for Kara.
Yeah.
So I would give it to Alex. Because, like, what did Kara have to do?
She had to convince the council, Tati.
Yeah, that's true. You didn't like Alex's plot either, so it's like...
Kara convinced the council with the power of her charm and her, you know...
empathy.
Maybe Serena is the one with gumption. Because she has the gumption to be two-faced and also to hear very reasonable arguments and still think that killing worlds is better than saving them.
Sure.
Well, I would agree with Alex, though, only because that even though
the plot
we didn't
we
didn't love the plot, she was still active in trying to find whoever was doing this and coming after her. So she was very active in it. And then she had like a personal realization, whereas Kara didn't. Other than like, I mean, she succeeded in her mission, but it was like, that was the...
I think she succeeded only because Allura was her mom.
Right. And Serena probably wanted her too, because that's part of the plan or whatever.
Exactly. Right. So, and also Alex was very calm under pressure, I feel. Like she didn't, you know, like even though she had like this added burden, quote unquote, of like not wanting anything to happen to her because of Ruby, she still was collected enough throughout. Like she didn't really make mistakes due to that new pressure.
So I think we're agreed. Alex is our Lady of Gumption for Supergirl this week. So now we're going to move over to side B, which will focus mainly on next season theories. Like most of the shows have had their finales. We're still waiting for Supergirl. But we do have some big things coming up for The Flash, and we know for Arrow, and also for the crossover. So we are going to get into that, and I'm going to let Tati set it up.
So we decided that we were going to talk about some comic book characters for Flash and Arrow, mostly because of Nora's reveal on Flash, and then the half Japanese, half white, half Street Fighter, half military tactician character that is going on Arrow. So first, on Flash, obviously, we are hoping that Dawn slash Nora will be part of the Tornado Twins and that we'll be getting her twin brother eventually. So I forced these lovely ladies to spend part of their weekend reading every Tornado Twins appearance, which is not that many. They basically almost don't exist in the comics. So it was actually not that difficult of a task. But the first thing that you guys need to know is that originally Tornado Twins were introduced in 1968 when they were just direct descendants of Barry. It didn't specify what they were to him because it was far in the future, right? It's like the 30th century. So we just assume that they're his descendants after a long line. And they didn't inherit speed because back then they being DC, did not think that the metagene was going to be an actual gene. It was just like, it has to happen to you and then you have powers and then that's the end. Mm-hmm. So they had to recreate powers in themselves to celebrate Flash Day and annoy the shit out of the Legion of Superheroes. And then the next time that we see them actually do something, because they appear like randomly in the background of other issues, but the next time that we actually get a real story on them is in Flash Volume 2, number 92, which is Wally's run as the Flash. And that's when they actually confirm that they are Barry and Iris's children, and now they've inherited speed, and they live in a time when you can't use your powers, which is why they have to hide them per Iris's command. They have to pretend like they are just regular human beings so they don't get murdered. And even though they have, like, you know how we complain about Caitlin's origin story being retconned 300 times on The Flash? That is actually mm-hmm. the most comic book thing they've ever done. Because even though the Tornado Twins have only appeared like 10 times, they have had their origin story like fixed 10 times. So I guess we can say the definitive one is the Tornado Twins were born after Barry died in the Crisis. In the 30th century, because Barry and Iris retired there after she came back to life when Eobard Thawne, quote-unquote, killed her. So, in the 30th century, it's run by President Thawne. EarthGov is where they live, and President Thawne has outlawed metahumans, right? There's a group of people called, like, there's science police and time police.
Yeah.
That stop you from using powers and also, you know, using time travel, etc. You can't do any of that shit. It's all illegal. So Iris has the Tornado Twins hide their powers, but when they meet Wally, he convinces them that they need to be heroes, right? Because it's what Barry would do. So they actually start using their powers and in fact use their powers to stop Dominators. There was a Dominator invasion. There's a whole like little crisis happening with those aliens that we met two seasons ago at this point, I guess. And President Thawne takes that opportunity to have them killed at that time. So I think it varies from version to version, but I think that at the end of the day, you can say he basically creates a scandal wherein they're doing something with the Dominators that they weren't. They were actually trying to save the world from the Dominators, but instead he says they were like turning over Earth's secrets or whatever, you know, and then has them publicly executed for being traitorous metahumans. So that's awesome. Mostly because he's just pissed that Dawn is married to Melanie and they have a baby. And then he also kidnaps Bart and tells Melanie that he died. Sorry about that. So then Iris is to rescue Bart
father
from
of
his
year.
Yes, father of the year. So then Iris is to rescue Bart from his speed prison that he's in, his virtual reality world. So that's the really sad and awful life of the Tornado Twins and Iris in the future. So, how do you guys think, what parts of their story do you guys think that they might incorporate into the show? And what parts of the, like, 3 seconds worth of material did you think were the most interesting?
Well, I have to say that I thought their first appearance was hilarious. Like, 1960s comics are just a little bit, like, ridiculous. It's kind of funny how some of, like, Stan language now you can kind of see in, like, the comics, because, like, when Don and Don kept beating the Legionnaires to all of, like, the crisis situations, the newspaper in the city started, like, calling the Legionnaires flops. Which I thought was, like, really funny. And I was like, you know, the first appearance, like, Don and Don are kind of like Bebe's kids. They're coming in and, like, beating up the Legionnaires and, like, taking credit for all this stuff and, like, thinking, like, they're better than them. And then it was kind of funny because, like, the DC writers were like, can you guess who this is? Like, they introduced themselves as, we're Don and Don Allen. But they're like, do you know who they are? Who they are, really? And can you find the clues? And I'm like, they're Don and Don Allen. And they sneak around. I'm pretty sure it's kind of obvious. Like, the writers in the 60s are just as obvious, or just as subtle, rather, as the writers on The Flash now. Like, as subtle as the writers of season 4 were about Nora being Barry Unitas' child, that's how subtle people in the 60s were about Don and Don Allen being related to The Flash. So not a lot of change with audiences. And also kind of reminded me of Ralph's first appearance, when he kept beating Barry to crime scenes and annoying the shit out of Barry to the point where that Barry thought that he was the actual criminal doing the scenes. And then, of course, they, like, you know, become besties afterwards. But it's kind of like the reason it was so ridiculous is at the end, they were just like, surprise, it was just for publicity. We don't have powers now, so you can't beat us up. Like, can you imagine this? Don, like, slash Nora. So Nora and her brother, this version of them on the show, I think I told Anon, you know, if they were maybe 7 and playing pranks on all the adults and, like, wreaking havoc around Star Labs, that would be cute and that would be hilarious. Mm-hmm. But 2 adults doing this is not as cute.
And I definitely, for,
as far as, like, storylines and where it will go, I think, you know, touching on what you were saying about their revised origin story about how they live in a society that where being a metahuman is illegal is going to tie into Nora's story on The Flash of this season. Because, like, also, like, with Cicada being the big bad and being able to strip metahuman powers, I think they could adapt the Earth 30th century illegal metahuman science beliefs, whatever, to being Cicada and his cult or followers or whatever going out of the way to killing metahumans, and that's what brings Dawn or slash Nora, who's no, she's, they're the same person, people. Like, Dawn is Nora and Nora is Dawn. She's not a different person just because her name is different. Her middle name is probably right. Dawn, so it's the same person.
I know people are suggesting they might be twins. And, like, they're Nora, not going to have 2 twin girls. They're not going to have 2 twin girls. I know why you think it, but it's not happening. Because they're not going to, even though there's nothing wrong with it, they're not going to have one of them be a single mom who gives Bart her last name. It's just not going to happen. So.
Yeah. But I think that's probably, like, the way that they're going to adapt it for the show. It's what my thought process is.
Yeah, and plus, like, I just, first, like, they changed the name to fuck with fans, you know, and that seemed to work because there were just people out there spinning the craziest shit. And then also to honor Barry's mom, and just, like, they changed Wally from being Iris's nephew to her brother. This is just that, basically. How dare you? But yeah, I mean, basically, it's just like that change. It's not that she's a changed character. She's just slightly altered to fit the scope of the show. But given that the first origin had the Tornado Twins doing the absolute most to just to celebrate Flash Day, it's no wonder that the show version of Nora Dawn would travel back in time to do something. And like, I do admit that I do like the second origin better, or the one that tends to stick. Like Jess said, they go from being questionable descendants of Barry Allen to being a part of the legacy that is the Flash family. And I love that they were kind of salty and jealous of Wally getting to know Barry when they didn't get the chance. And also, Wally was jealous of them because they were Barry's biological children. He wasn't. So there was, like, that good family dynamic that I hope they can mine. I know, that they can mine on the show. And in one of the issues, Dawn is the one warning her brother to not tell her dad too much about the future. And they have, like, a believable bickering in different instances. But I just like that that was funny, because now she's, like, the one traveling back in time, fucking with the time stream. And I think what struck me specifically when I was reading them is Wally being baffled why they weren't helping when the reveal of their powers would get them in trouble. But then he's like, "You're Allen's. Do something." And I think if things really are that bad in the future, it would make Nora Dawn come back to the past on the show to fix it, because that's who she is and who her family is, even if it can be dangerous.
Yeah.
And I thought the fact that they wanted to protect Iris from losing them the way that she lost Barry was incredibly sad, and something I would want to see on the show between Nora and Iris, so long as Barry gets to actually live.
I was so sad. I wanted to die.
Yeah. But I think something like that could, like, certainly make for an interesting dynamic between mother and daughter. And overall, I think the combination of super speed and Nora's adorableness, and in the comics Iris describing her as headstrong versus Dawn's studious and timid nature, make her the more ideal candidate for time traveling, so it makes sense. But I believe, and like based on the recent interview with Jessica Parker Kennedy from the London Comic Con, that the other layer to her character she can't talk about will be her twin brother. And I think that he won't make a physical appearance during season 5, but I think they could make it so he's in danger as a consequence of her actions, and that's why he's not around. Or if both their existence is threatened and she'd already time traveled, then it also makes sense for him not to be there. But I do think she'll bring him up. Yeah, so I mean, there's just so many stories that they can do, even though that the Tornado Twins themselves don't really appear very much or have, like, as a rich or fully fleshed out history as some of the other Flash family members. But I still think they could use a Jenny story here or a Bart story there. But either way, I don't think they'd get rid of Nora's brother on the show, since he is Bart's dad, and I imagine they'd want Bart to appear later on in the series at some point.
Yeah. There are so many parts to their story that are alluded to in the comics that we don't actually see, because they don't actually have a comic, or they don't actually, you know, they've never actually devoted a whole series to them. So they can have a lot of room to flesh that out on screen, as well as, like you were saying, there's this whole extended family, and like everyone around them has like 300 stories that stem from theirs. So this would be an excellent opportunity for Flash to get ahead of the comics for once and actually give us their story. As for how I think it'll tie in, I do really like the idea of Cicada being what leads to Nora's future, right? And I really hope they have never successfully done this before with Flash. I mean, Flash has never tried to do it. Legends has done it. But I hope that Flash will tie into Legends with the future being the same as Zari's future. I'm hoping that we're going to get to see some kind of, like, cross there in the crossover, for example. Nora and Zari can find out that they come from the same timeline. And so then
Zari comes from what, 2024?
2040.
2040. Oh, okay. I see. Yes. Okay.
42 or something. She comes from like 4 years after Nora would presumably come from. So I would like it if defeating Cicada by the end of season 5 actually affects Zari's future, you know? Because Legends is good about doing that. Like, oh shit, something's changed. And you don't actually have to actively go through the steps to change it, but actually just see the results of it. So I hope we get that. Yeah, that's pretty much, and obviously I hope that we get at least a reference to Donovan by the time that Nora leaves.
I feel like the other thing that they could do in the spirit of Flash Riders ripping off other Speedster storylines is give Nora kind of Bart's from his storyline from the Young Justice because he's in that story, he's from 2056, and it's really dystopian. Pretty much there's nothing left, there's no home for him there, and so he went back in time to stop one event in particular, and I think it has something to do with like this kind of like nuclear man. So he's trying to like stop something from that, and it's basically because the Reach, which is like this massive alien organization, come into power and lead to the destruction of his time period. So he was coming back to stop that, which you know, interacts with his grandparents and spoils Iris's pregnancy accidentally. I think that that's probably the only part of it that would be similar with Nora. The fact that she's coming back and interacting with her parents. But I do feel like the illegal metahuman storyline with the Tornado Twins from the comics blended with Cicada is what we're going to get. So it could be like really exciting, and I don't know if that'll tie into the crossover at all. I don't know if we want to take David Ramsey in his big mouth as more of like with a grain of salt or not, but he said at one convention recently, a fan asked him about if they would ever want their characters to do, you know, in either an alt Earth or an alt timeline where they were bad guys instead of the good guys, and David alluded that that was going to be happening in the crossover, which could, I don't know, I mean, it doesn't really affect Arrow since none of them are actually like metahumans, but as far as like The Flash and some of the other shows, The Legends and Supergirl, being illegal in that time period would make them quote unquote villains. Or
mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Yeah, so we'll see.
I very much want that to happen.
Yes, lots of good potential. I'm excited.
All right. It's time for Arrow. Now, if we are not correct about this casting call, then this will have been totally useless, but at least you will learn about the strange and circular nature of Arrow's publication and television history. So, as you may or may not know, Thea Queen was based on Mia Dearden from the Arrow comics, who was actually created by Kevin Smith, and she was an HIV-positive prostitute that Oliver kind of took in and like helped train, and then she sort of became not really Speedy, because Speedy was Roy, but you know, she became like his sidekick for a period of time, and then they turned that into Thea, which was his sister, and then in 2013 they added a half sister for Oliver, except her name was Emiko Queen, and she is the daughter of Shadow, because in this run in the New 52, Shadow was actually Robert Queen's girlfriend, or, you know, side piece, whatever you want to call her, and not Oliver's, which is weird, but that's all right. So, Emiko Queen is part of a group in, they're called like the Outsiders Arrow Clan. I think they're just called the Arrow Clan. And she thought that she was the daughter of a different enemy who's like, I think his last name was LaCroix. I can't remember his first name, but he was this evil dude who basically kidnapped her from Shadow and raised her as his own. Simon LaCroix, that was his name. Simon LaCroix, who's also known as Komodo. So she then finds out when she's introduced in 2013, she finds out that she's actually Shadow and Robert's daughter, and Oliver sort of like fights LaCroix in order to rescue her from her kidnapper. But for her, it's not really a rescue, right? She's like, all I've known is being an outsider. So she wants to stay with them, but then she decides that she will join Oliver in his quest, and then she basically wants to be like his best sidekick ever and like his only sidekick. You don't need other sidekicks, you only need me. until the Rebirth era, where her loyalties are divided between her mother and her brother. So there's another evil group called the Ninth Circle that Shadow basically like owes money to, right? Like there's like jobs that Shadow had not fulfilled for them. So she has to kill Oliver Queen on their behalf. and Emiko helps her. So you're like, Emiko, why? But then really, she left Oliver some stuff so that he could survive and then, like, contacted John Diggle and all this shit so that, you know, to help him out. So she was really, like, playing both sides the whole time. And then they eventually, like, fight the Ninth Circle so that Shadow is free of them. Because Shadow doesn't want to hurt her daughter either, right? Shadow would choose her daughter over the Ninth Circle. But Emiko doesn't want her mom to die. Lots of problems. Anyway, Shadow's like, thanks, goodbye. And now Emiko is the Red Arrow, hanging out with Oliver and saving him and Dinah from stuff. So all's well that ends well. it's interesting to me because it's kind of like the inverse of Thea's storyline, in that Thea thinks that she's Robert Queen's daughter. Then she finds out she's not. She's actually the daughter of Evil Dude. And then you think she's going to work with Evil Dude, but really, he just drugs her and makes her kill someone without her knowledge. And then she has bloodlust for a while. But all's well that ends well on that front, too. So, first off, do we think that this is the casting call that we saw? And how do we think that they can incorporate her without just being super repetitive?
I mean, it has to be. I have no other, like, yes, it has to be her. Otherwise, what are they doing? It's kind of funny because Emiko's storyline also seems, like, oddly reminiscent of Artemis and her storyline in Young Justice with her and Cheshire, which is her sister. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was, they recycle storylines within the comics as well. So, like, Emiko is a new Artemis, I guess. But I feel like, I wonder if she'll come in knowing that Oliver is her brother, or if it'll be a little bit of a rivalry with, what was the guy's name from Dinah's boyfriend that was meeting, like, Oliver to all these, like, crime scenes? And it was kind of like he couldn't die.
Vincent?
Yes. What was his name, though? Like, his super name.
Couldn't die.
Wow.
It doesn't matter. What I'm saying.
I don't remember.
Wait, is this from the show? No, I now need to. This is from the show?
Brother, like, Blood? Was it Brother Blood?
No.
Okay,
it doesn't matter.
Okay.
It doesn't matter. But, like, my point was, are they, is she going to show up, like, Tornado Twin style, where she's, like, being arrogant and beating all of the Team Arrow to shit and be like, surprise, it's Anne and your sister? Or yes, will she come in knowing that Oliver is her brother, but Oliver not knowing that she's a sister? Is what I'm wondering.
Oh.
I think...
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, I think what struck me was, like, how... So she was introduced in 2013, so it was after the show had already started. And I feel like now, you know, they were bickering, and she was like, I'm Green Arrow, and he's like, no, that's my name. And I thought it was... If she does end up being his half-sister on the show, I think it's interesting that they would give him two half-sisters, but one on his mom and one on his dad's side. And I feel like, given that the show has kind of made Robert Queen be somewhat of a shady person, it would further give Ollie daddy issues to contend with and a new dynamic with Emiko, potentially. But my theory is that if they are to introduce the Longbow Hunters, I feel like Emiko could be introduced that way, and she'll be, like, the link with that, because Shadow was in the series run for the Longbow Hunters in the comics. And I think that that's how they can link it back to what's going on.
What if she's one of them? She could be one of them.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure, yes. I think that Emiko will be connected to the Longbow Hunters. I'm totally with you on that. And my question is actually, do we think that she, like, is the half-sister side of it really important? I mean, I feel like it is, but would they get rid of that so as not to be super obviously replacing Thea? Or
I think Oliver needs some family, because he has none right now. You know, Felicity, he doesn't really treat like
a family. Yo, William, how dare you?
I know, he has... I know he loves William, but, like, he doesn't. Okay.
The other option.
His sister is gone. Quentin, who's like a father figure to him, is gone. His mom is gone. His dad is gone. He does have William, but like I feel like he at least needs more family because as the show has gone on, they've progressively just gotten rid of all of them. So
I agree. I was about to say like, oh, what if she's actually Shadow's daughter and she's Oliver's daughter? But then I was like, nope, can't do that because then she would be 10. She would be 10 years old. So. And also, when did Shadow hide her pregnancy? So never mind. Makes no damn sense. But she could be Shadow's twin, right? How Shadow had a twin or something, right?
Yeah.
She could be Shadow's twin's daughter. Hmm. And then just have that connection to Shadow with no, you know.
Oh.
Or literally Shadow's twin could have hooked up with...
Wait, Robert, oh my god. Wait, is she still alive, right? She's still alive.
Yeah, she's alive, because he went to go, he saw her, and he was like, oh shit, it's Shadow, and then he was like, nope, it's her sister.
Did he see her in Japan, or did he see her in China? I can't remember where he was when he saw her. But she's also not Japanese, so I mean, unless, like, Shadow's twin is living in Japan, or like...
Shadow's not Japanese?
I don't think she's Japanese.
She's Japanese in the comics, but you're right, she's the actress is from Hong Kong. So he saw her in Hong Kong, and that's what it was.
Yeah. And, like, I think she's not Japanese on the show.
Okay, well, then that's obviously, she's obviously not Shadow's child or related to Shadow, because the thing literally said Japanese, so.
She's not related to Kitana, because that'd be, like, weird.
That would be, I mean, yeah, I guess Kitana, nope, because Kitana would have to know that she had another child. So I guess she could be somewhat related to Kitana without, but then again, it wouldn't be Oliver's half-sister. That would just be too. Circling the drain. Yeah. But yeah, I feel like this is definitely the character that Steven was saying he was really excited about seeing in season 7. So
I agree. Yep. It'll certainly give him more material to work with too. So that's why he's probably excited.
Yeah. Do we have any other thoughts?
No.
It reached its natural conclusion.
Yes, yes. I do think that they can pull from Oregon. Like, I know they have the Longbow Hunters already. Like, that is already a story in the comics, and they'll probably pull from it. But there's so many secret organizations in Green Arrow comics that they can probably do an amalgamation since they're never going to.
And not from Batman.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. There is some good stuff in the Green Arrow comics. They don't have to pull from Batman constantly. So I am glad they are going in its... Green Arrow specific route. Next up, we have our newest addition to the Arrowverse that we know nothing about yet, Batwoman. So, I did not pull shit for Batwoman, but we obviously know she's part of the Bat family, and she is, at least now, the first appearance of this version of Batwoman, which is the one that we assume that they are going to be using. Kate Kane, who is an out lesbian and a Jewish woman, was in 2011 because she came with the New 52. Now, she has a twin sister named Beth, and they are Batman's cousins on his mother's side. His mother was a Kane, and then she had a brother named Jake Kane who had two twins. Well, they'll have one set of twins, actually. That's how that works. Anyway. She's a socialite, but she's also, you know, like a military tactician, because why not? And then she also somehow has time to be Batwoman. So she's an amazing lady, girl power. I don't know what specific like stories, because like we really have literally no idea where they're going to start with her, you know, or what connection she might have to, it sounds like Arrow is really the way it's going to be introducing her. You know? But I don't know. Do you guys have any ideas for how they might connect the two of them?
I think it would be really cool if they actually use the legends to throw everyone into the future, and that's how they meet her.
That she's in the future?
Yeah. Like, then they could tie in... They could tie in Nora's story a little bit. They could bring in Batwoman and have her be there, but she's, like, not there in the... our present time, and then if they ever want to do like a spin-off, they could just set it in whatever future world she's in. Yeah, that's probably not gonna. It's probably not gonna happen.
But. I mean, I actually really want that. I really want her to be in this future where metahumans are illegal, which is why she takes up the mantle and becomes a vigilante because she has no powers. So she's like, "Well, this isn't illegal, bitch." Like, that's what I want. But but I know that people are resistant to that because they want her to be able to get her own show very easily. And then for that show to be able to cross over with the shows that they already watch.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I get why. Yeah. But then it's like, I don't know, I guess we do know that both Supergirl and Arrow have referenced Gotham City before. Because Oliver referenced Bruce Wayne, and there was that rando in, I think, the season premiere of Supergirl, season 2 premiere, where they're like, I'm going back to Gotham.
But there was also Arrow used to reference Bloodhaven, like, twice back in, like, season 2.
Yeah. So I'm just saying that those are the two shows that have referenced it. So she could either be from Earth 1 or Earth 38. 38, that is Supergirl.
Yeah, right?
Okay. It's just really hard to imagine how they're going to rope her in through a crossover and not through her own, like, pilot, especially having her be Batwoman in reference to a Batman that we're not seeing. It'll be interesting.
Right. I'm guessing if the crossover is going to be the first time that we see her. So, and apparently the key is going to be through Arrow. So what in Arrow would be happening to lead to, like, is the crossover going to happen in Gotham? And then, like, how do you get Kara over there? Like, what's the catalyst that gets Kara to switch Earth to come over here and fight our battles in Earth 1 when she's clearly at Supergirl at Earth 38?
Yeah. It is interesting because every year Kara has had to come here to help them. They're not going over there to help her, so I don't know.
Well, to be fair, she is one, and they're, like, multiple.
That's true. That is not a lie. What was I going to say about it? Do we have any thoughts? Like, obviously we don't, because we haven't come up with them yet, but we know very well how we think she would fit into the future, but what is a good idea that we can pitch to the writers right now for how she fits into the present?
Well, I feel like if she is to exist in our present time, I think they would have to make an excuse for Batman to either be gone or something for him not to be around. But on Supergirl, they also have Superman, and they never use him, and he's around, so I guess it doesn't really matter.
I would love... Well, no. No, I'm not going to split that in the universe, because if it's going to be Batman, I want it to be, you know, Kate Kane-centered. But I was going to say that I would love if Bruce was casted and made, like, a cameo, even if he didn't, like, do anything. But then I feel like everyone would just be talking about Bruce and his cameo instead of Kate.
Exactly. Kane. You got to give Kate her moment to shine.
Throwing out
Renee Montoya.
Yes, we can have at least Renee Montoya. But I don't know, as far as the story, I have no idea how they're gonna make it so that it's, because we do know from Stephen Amell that this is more grounded story. There's not gonna be, like, aliens, and there's no Nazis going, you know, coming over to our Earth or whatever. So I don't know what kind of story they intend to do that will bring her over.
Unless it's the Quadrant. Because the Quadrant is supposed to be this, like, all-powerful secret criminal organization or whatever. So the Quadrant would probably theoretically have reach in Gotham.
And maybe she shows up in, like, the episode before the crossover. There's, like, surprise appearance near the end when he's fighting someone in the Quadrant. And she shows up to help. And then he's like, who is this masked vigilante? And then,
or what if he, like, goes to Gotham to, like, track down someone from the Quadrant? And she's like, who the fuck are you? Get off my turf.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would be one way to do it. And then he's like, hey, you know what? I've got some friends who can help with this. And that way it wouldn't affect his arc, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever the Arrow arc for the season is. He would go, like you said, he goes to Gotham. And he's like, hey, I've got some friends who can help with this. And then everyone goes over there to help. And then Iris calls them the Justice League, and the articleist writes about it. The end. You're welcome.
Yeah, I was going to say, I assume they're going to introduce them as some sort of TV Justice League by the end of the crossover this year. Especially if this could be Arrow's last season.
In which case, which characters do you think on Arrow will cross over to Batwoman if she gets picked up for, like, if we're saying that this crossover leads to maybe her getting a show, then do we think, and if it's Arrow's last season?
Okay, so we're saying if Arrow gets canceled, who would go over?
I feel like,
yeah, right? Like, do you think that they would set up Dinah to go over to be there and do like a Birds of Prey kind of thing?
Yes. I was just gonna say Dinah is who would go over, yes. Yeah.
Dinah, for sure. And I would like, I mean, Renee would be fun too if he just hung around, but definitely like Dinah, and they could have a girl gang.
They probably, because they need a tech person, because that is how people function in this universe, so probably Curtis.
Yes, Curtis would be their guy at the desk, because you can't have, like, I'm sure no matter how popular Felicity is, if you have her crossover after Arrow ends without Oliver, then people are just going to be sitting there like, where's Oliver? Why? What is happening to Felicity? So it would be better if it was Curtis and Dinah.
Yeah.
I guess they could probably find a...
Yeah, and that's only if they're not going to build their own world around her, which they should. So, you know, they could get a tech person on her show that's not Curtis. So it's not just like, Arrow Part 2, but in Gotham.
Yeah. Right, for sure.
Yeah.
And that would be the first time, like, the only show that they've built around characters from other shows is Legends. And everyone and Legends at the start was, like, someone who had introduced in another show. So they don't need to do that with Batwoman. She does have her own people. Like, for example, Julia Pennyworth would be her tech person. Mm-hmm. Who is, like... She is a woman of color. Yeah, Julia in Batwoman is a black woman. Or biracial, right. Obviously, because she's Alfred Pennyworth's niece, so obviously part of her is white. But yes. So she does have her own tech person, and there's no reason that they wouldn't.
I would like that than Curtis, to be honest. Sorry, Curtis. No more sex for you.
he forgives.
So I think even if they might have it for, like, an episode, you know, like, they could introduce it with, like, Curtis and Felicity even there to help her set it up, and then they go away, and we get her actual team.
I don't want that for her to set up anything, to be honest, because she's already been across all the shows, and I don't need this to happen.
Julia can do it on her own. PSA for all of you Maggie Sawyer fans. No.
No, exactly. Like, you don't even want her with KK, and you want her with Alex, so just...
Right,
like,
just no.
Renee Montoya is Latina.
I hope they go with her other canon love interest and not... I mean, you can't do Maggie, because Maggie's already been used, and she's on Supergirl, so it's a whole different Earth and all that other stuff, and it's just... She's not played by... an actual woman of color, so no. no.
I do definitely want to see Renee Montoya. So if she made a cameo in the crossover as the police officer in Gotham.
Ooh.
Where Pat Kane is.
That would be a great way to, like, hint at it. That's where they're going. So I would love to see Renee Montoya.
Start tweeting this, please, for Tatiana. Anyway. Any other thoughts?
I'm shaking my head because you can't hear me. Or can you hear me? She can't hear me.
We're done.
Can you tell I still can't hear you?
She says it's okay. We're done.
Okay. All right. So thank you, all of you students of DCTV, for listening to us theorize or not theorize, and let us know your thoughts on how Tornado Twins will be incorporated, on who the mysterious street fighter, military tactician, half Japanese, half white character on Arrow is, and finally, how they'll incorporate Kate Kane. And if you have other DCTV related suggestions for what we can do over hiatus, please let us know, because we only have like 4 or 5 ideas, and then we need the comments and suggestion box. And, of course, find us on DCTV Gumption on Twitter and Ladies W Gumption on Tumblr and ladieswgumption@gmail.com.